Welcome again to a Holden Village lecture, and this is being held in the Creekside Room at Holden Village in the Koinonia building. David Fagerberg is continuing his discussion of Breaking Bread, the Oldest Form. So now let's just move to the Creekside Room and David.
You know where you are, and therefore you know who I am, David Fagerberg. Unless someone's in here expecting beginning weaving or Spanish one or something, this is a session on liturgy. But I'd like to, just for other people's benefit and in the spirit of Holden, again go around the room once for introductions. You can use first name only if you have something to hide. You don't have to give an occupation if you're not so inclined, but just names on the round.
I'm Gary Knudsen from Rice Lake, Wisconsin.
I'm Valerie Peterson from Hudson, Wisconsin, and Hong Kong.
Bill Giddings from Tacoma, Pacific Lutheran University.
Bob Roach from Wayzata, I'll say. It's near Minneapolis.
Chris Widener from Reading, Pennsylvania.
Lowell Rudolph from St. Paul.
Carol Rudolph from St. Paul. Arson Giddings from Tacoma, Washington.
Hello, and we just finished going around on names, so.
Elaine Koenig, no doubt, yes.
You made a dramatic entrance with the last person. I've been adjusting and tinkering the comments I've intended to make, given the audience, given the size, given the circumstances of discussion around and about. So I'm going to jam two things together today. One is a extended illustration, which I will ask you to help me with. I assume that you will remember illustrations longer than you'll remember any piece of information that I distribute. So I'm stripping out the information and giving you a analogy that you can play with yourself long after. And then I'm going to indulge myself with what I believe could best properly be titled a harangue. But that'll be another thing later. I may make the claim that liturgy is a species in the genus ritual. Not all rituals are liturgies, not all liturgies are ritual, but liturgy is a ritual. So I'd like to think a little bit about rituals first. And this is in the design of kind of sneaking up on the topic. This is always dangerous to do, because when there are religiously minded folks and you try to sneak up on a religious topic, they jump the gun for you, like the kid in the children's sermon who was asked what has a bushy tail and is gray and climbs up trees and gathers nuts, and he said, "I was going to say a squirrel, but I suppose you're talking about Jesus again." People tend to leap ahead of you too fast. And so I don't want you to do that. We're just, don't read anything into anything yet. I want to talk about structures of a rite. One of the words in liturgical studies that gets a lot of usage is this term structure, or Gregory Dix's term shape, or rhythm, or pattern, or if you're a computer literate, format. Format the disc, format the rite, structure of a rite. And let's pick a rite at random. Well, not really, I have it in mind. Let's say it's a structure of a dinner party. No, I'm not sneaking up on the Eucharist. Just a dinner party, like when people used to come over to your house. Now, let me try to set the scene a little bit. This is a rather nice dinner party, all right? The one that I'm imagining that you're going to help me set. It's not come on over and slap on the feed bag kind of invitation. Let's say I've sent out written invitations. Arrive at 6, we'll dine at 7. We aren't even going to eat at this dinner party, we're going to dine. Go till 10 or 11 if you need to let the babysitter know. That's the kind of dinner party that I have in mind. But having only recently advanced from instructors to assistant professor's salary, let's say I've never thrown a dinner party before. We haven't had the means and wherewithal to do so. So I'd like you to help me plan it out rather carefully, step by step. I'll assume, going out on a limb on this one, but I'll assume that first of all, I will meet people at the door and greet them. But then what? What's next? What's the next act that happens at a dinner party?
Take their coats. If it's winter.
Put them up on your parents' bedroom where that smell of strangers' coats fills the room. Yes, I remember that. And then?
Probably introduce them. Is that good? Yes. Invite them to sit down. Maybe offer them something to drink.
Now I'm going to hint something else out of you. Is all of this happening like
music?
Could be music in the background. Any other noise?
Conversation.
I'm assuming that I don't take the coat and give intros and sit down all in dead silence, that there's chattering going on here. What does one talk about?
Small talk.
At this point of the dinner party, it's rather small.
The weather.
The weather.
How'd you been?
I love what you've done with this place. It's this new wallpaper.
Right.
Like, here's one of the first morals we can draw from this structuring. When there's a structure of a ritual, you know that something happens here. You don't know what the conversation is about. That'll be different at every dinner party. But you know that conversation goes on here. Well, we could say even more. The conversation is of a certain type that you are able to identify. I don't say, "Hello, John, what do you think of the prospects of peace in the Middle East?" It's too startling. Save that for later. It's conversation. It has a certain type of conversation as well. All right, so we've got something to drink, conversation. What next? Or what more? Or what do I do next? I'm a petrified host.
Well, usually someone is in the kitchen and someone is in with the guests to keep the guests comfortable until the kitchen is ready to serve.
And how do I keep these guests comfortable?
Hors d'oeuvres.
Which I never risk misspelling. I call them munchies. And what shall we serve at tonight's hors d'oeuvres? Mm. We'll get rather particular.
What's the theme?
Theme dinner party. No, none of that.
Oh, some bread and crackers and cheese.
C&C.
I've learned something over the years doing that many times. I depend upon the guests to talk to one another.
Well, you can get in and out of the kitchen.
Well, no, I am there too, but they initiate stuff. And it's really nice to know that you can relax a little bit and know they're going to do that. I mean, especially if you've invited people that are interesting. Or they're interested in each other, or they know each other.
Let me step
more
out.
Conversation, maybe.
Let me step outside the illustration for a moment. So I'll move physically to make sure you understand. And just invite you in the future to ruminate about the connection between being a good host or hostess and being a presider at liturgy. There would be two extremes that would seem to me fail. One extreme would be, "Hi, come here, you sit right there, okay? Are you talk? What are you going to talk about?" And going around doing everything for everyone, right? So what you said reminded me of it. You can rely upon the guests, the participants, to do something.
There's a ritual for them as well as for you.
Right.
But there's another extreme of being a bad host or hostess, and that would be, well, let's describe it like if I sat up on the steps trying to stay out of everyone's way. I'm just a servant here. I'm not hosting. I'm not presiding. I don't want to get in your way. do you need something? I'll run down and help out, and then I'll go back and sit. I've seen cases in which the presider sins in one degree or the other, either totalitarianly or else having no contribution to make towards the hospitality and graciousness of the moment. So just think about the host being too manipulative and being too laissez-faire. All right, we got munchies, we got conversation, this and that. What now?
Where's the restroom?
Hospitality. Let's say we point out the rest over here. Restrooms when they take their coats.
Oh, that's good.
Okay. It's sometime the main course and you sit down for the meal, right?
Yep.
So there's a spatial shift from the living room to the dining room here. Mm-hmm. Words. So now we go into the living room, dining room, I mean to say. And the leg of lamb comes right out first.
So you're seated in some order of some.
Seated,
and some plan.
You guys are pretty good at this. Invite me if you ever have an opportunity, but what else?
Well, then we start waiting for the hostess to do what hostesses have to do, or hosts.
Clink, clank.
They sit, they pray, or they pray and then sit, and then they wait for their hostess to pick up her napkin or his napkin.
Let's say it's not on the table yet. What comes out from the kitchen first?
Soup.
Or
salad.
Oh, now you've confused
me. Maybe the salad's already there.
I told you I'm a neophyte in throwing dinner parties. I want to know, which is it, soup or salad?
Okay, it's salad in the middle of the plate.
Soup's first.
Soup would come first, I think.
Who would serve soup first?
Unless you're in China, then it's nuts. That's
right.
Which raises another little access to this whole story. What if you weren't in Rome, but were in Constantinople? How much force does the structure of the dinner party hold? I told you not to jump ahead, and I was. Super salad, does it matter? Is it important?
No.
Maybe, maybe not.
As long as there's something.
After the... After the super salad or the salad or soup, then what?
Might pour up some wine.
Then? What do you want to serve?
Beef Wellington. That's not a Holden-like thing to say, but it just came out.
So in 3 days, I was a vegetarian diet already.
Correct.
Spinach souffle or...
Not ever having that very once in my life. Let's have it now.
It sounds elegant and extravagant, which is another thought. You don't generally serve hot dogs and chips if you're going to do this up well. I mean, there's a certain wastefulness to the...
Bread.
So, beef Wellington, and what else is going on at this dinner party?
Candlelight.
They're getting more boisterous.
Atmosphere.
Yes.
You mean they're still talking, more talking.
Oh, yeah.
People are probably looking forward to what's coming next if it's all done kind of and lovely and smells good. And
okay.
Then they're enjoying
anticipations.
Mm-hmm.
Tell me, is this talk the same or different than this talk?
Different.
It's different now.
It is different.
Maybe more intimate because you're conversing with...
It's more sustained because you're staying in the same place too. Whereas in the early church, when you roam around, there you sit and stay. Yeah. For a while.
Which may change the topic, may change the level of engagement in the topic. So again, it's like something goes here. It can have different contents. Something goes here. The conversation topic differs, but in the structure of the ritual, we not only have a space carved out for it, there's even different shaped spaces carved out for it. There's a different kind of talking here, a different kind of talking there. I'm working on the tension between structure and liberty. You can talk about whatever you want at my dinner party. And if I handed out little sheets of paper for you to all read, oh, hello, nice to see you. Hi, welcome to... That would be really odd. It'd also be odd if you did the small chat here and the more substantial talk here. There is a shape, there's a rhythm, there's a pattern, et cetera, et cetera.
Let's get on to dessert. That's my favorite.
Well, all right. I was going to ask you, are we ready to go to next? Do you serve dessert at the table or back in the dining room, living room?
I would at the table.
That's a very good
deal. Unless you're Scandinavian, unless you're Norwegian, then you go to a different room.
To the coffee table, yes.
Yes,
for coffee.
Well, let's say the dessert is here.
They bring it to the table with coffee or something?
Yeah.
Dessert plus coffee.
Yeah, sometimes we adjourn, go back into the other room, and then come back an hour later and have dessert. That's been...
Back to the table.
Because we eat too much at the...
Retro.
That gives us a chance to get the stuff off the table that we don't want there and get the dessert to the table.
I find, though, if it's a party... I know this is a real elegant, but often if it's a gathering of people we know well, we just stay at the table. And get anything get sort of pushed. I mean, that's sort of part of the feeling. It's real nice, and the dessert comes, and things get cleared. But we just stay seated.
And now you can really talk.
Yeah, it's an enjoyment kind of.
Let's suppose, because I'd like to include some kind of closure ritual to this ritual, that after dessert and coffee, we go back into the living room for another hour and a half or two. What goes on there? Twister. No, bring the games out. What now in this closing part of the dinner party?
Well, people select conversational groups, I suppose.
Oh, more conversation. What do you know? A third time shows up. Different than this one?
Well, you've chosen your guests with view of the fact that they probably have something in common to talk about.
And you've all shared this meal so that you have that.
It's created some.
That sort of
getting acquainted and it
brought you together as well.
Enough, I would think.
Yeah.
So once again, it happens, but the style of it can happen. And I'll continue to make coffee available. And if any glutton wants a third piece of pie, they may dare ask me. Little sherry, go for it.
Sometimes not it's not always group conversation. It's a little like one on one right beside you and then to the other side of you or something like that. It's a large dinner party. And if you and then when you go back and you gather in the bigger room, then it kind of can be a conversation of a larger group.
This has been moving in and out, has been pointed out. This is restricted to perhaps here they start puddling into groups. Used to be the men in the library with cigars and cognac, right?
But I think too, because we've all had that center time together at the table, we're all kind of relaxed and we all sort of function as one, even though there might be different groups of conversation, everybody's sort of feeling
at home.
Yeah, kind of, if cozy is the word, I don't know if that's the word, but...
It's created a, well, community.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. May I remind you that the word companion comes from cum panis, which means to break bread together. Mm-hmm. There are bread breakers. Cum panis. And then let's just say there's a goodbye ritual. My students always look funny at me when I suggest that they are ritual creatures. They don't tend to believe that, but I remind them that in Moorhead, Scandinavians have a goodbye ritual, and it takes an obligatory 18 and a half minutes. You must announce that you intend to leave, and then let 12 minutes go by. Then you must stand up and announce it again. Then you must stand with your coat on in your hand on the doorknob for at least 5 minutes. If anyone said, well, I'm going to leave now, and walked out the door, this would be terribly rude. Ritual is a pattern of human behavior, and there's a goodbye ritual that you get acculturated to.
You left the car door, stand by the car door.
Garrison Keillor describes one glove on, one glove off, probably waiting for the car to warm up. Yes, you can add the winter permutation of the goodbye ritual. Well, all right, say I've even got color. I'll be bold here. This is my imaginary scene, so my imagination continues. I'm slaving over the beef Wellington. When the doorbell rings, I expect my first guest to be here. I go to the door, and all all 15 of my guests are standing on my sidewalk, which strikes me as odd in the first place. Do guests usually come in a bus to the dinner party? How did this happen? And they say to me, I'm making this up as I go along, gee, there's been an emergency in town. The school burned down, and half of us are on the school board, and half of us are on the fire board, and we have to have an emergency meeting tonight to decide what to do and how this happened. So we can't stay all night at your dinner party. We have to leave early. We don't have 4 hours. We only have about an hour and a half. Shall we call it off? I say, oh, no, you're all dressed up, looking so good. I've got 24 pounds of beef Wellington. Maybe I overcooked, I don't know, in the kitchen here. Let's go ahead and do the dinner party. We'll just truncate it. We'll shorten her up in some way. So now, I'm going to ask you how you're going to truncate your dinner party. You got this one. That's a freebie. And I'll give you this one as a freebie. But now say you had only 5 more components on here. Sometimes I make it hard and say 4, but I'll give you some leeway. 5 actions. What are you going to keep? What are you going to let go?
Keep the beef Wellington.
1. 2. The voice is stuck up here.
How did you take their coats off?
Yeah, we have to. Oh, all right, all right. And you have to have, I'll give you that one as part of the greeting. That's another free
conversation. It's a conversation. Yeah.
All right, that one. Now, which part of the conversation?
Well, right to the heart.
Keep that beginning, maybe. Sort of so that people might feel comfortable.
All right. It might slide a little towards that one, too. But okay. There's 3. Yeah, I have 2 more.
I would skip the munchies.
Yeah.
Skip the munchies.
Yeah. Okay.
Unless the beef Wellington isn't done. It can't be so.
Do it raw, right?
No, I'm a nervous cook, and I was going to have everything overdone already. So don't confuse me.
If the food was ready, I would just greet them, take their coats, and whiz them straight in there.
Sit to the table.
They all go straight to the table. 4.
And you've got a choice between soup, salad, or wine. What do you want?
Keep the wine.
Yeah. Keep the salad.
This is always an interesting psychological experience here about what jumps first. Dessert.
You've got an hour and a half. You can manage soup, salad, and beef Wellington all in one meal.
All right, I'll give you the wine and either the soup or the salad, but not both. Yeah, we'll give you the salad. Now, my point here is, how did you know what to keep?
What do you like?
Did your parents one time sit you down and say, well, son, daughter, now that you know the facts about the birds and the bees, there's one more piece of information I need to pass on to you before you go out into the world so you can make your way in society? The structure of a dinner party. In case you ever have to truncate a dinner party, this is what you better keep. Who taught anyone in here the structure of dinner parties?
It's what makes the people as comfortable as they can be as quickly as possible. That's what you keep. What you think will make them comfortable.
Shall it be primarily what I think it is because it's my dinner party?
That's all you can do.
Or shall it be what makes them comfortable? Supposing I was throwing this dinner party and I decided to
skip the dessert.
Take your coats, put on a little music, serve you some crackers and a piece of dessert and a cup of coffee. Wouldn't that be kind of an odd evening's experience?
You have to keep the main part of the meal.
Somehow we know how to do that.
In other words, if it's going to be a dinner party, and if it's going to be a dinner party, then you better have food and you better have hospitality, graciousness. Liturgies have, as Robert Taft calls them, hard points and soft points. Hard points you must do at every liturgy. Soft points you may do if you have the time, if it's a celebration, if it's a party. All rubrics have some way of distinguishing hard points from soft points. Lutheran Book of Worship made it easy on purpose because the rubrics that are soft and dispensable all on purpose include the word may. But not very many people seem to necessarily know that, because though the Kyrie and Hymn of Praise say may, you find many people who keep the munchies and skip Beef Wellington. Have you not seen cases in which something special is going on? Bible Sunday, Cub Scout Sunday, installation of Sunday school teachers. Oh, we got a shortened sermon. Those damn announcements ran 10 minutes already anyway, so shorten the whole service. We'll skip 2/3 of the Word of God, Old Testament and Epistle lesson, but we'll keep that Kyrie, which was a papal entrance rite for stational liturgies in Rome in the first place. Keep the crackers, but skip the Beef Wellington. That's going to happen unless people know the what's a hard point and what's a soft point in a liturgy. What's required and what's dispensable. Required? Ooh, that sounds like law. Well, yes and no. Law in the sense of rules, format, obligation. There are no etiquette police running around checking on whether or not you're throwing a dinner party like this. Miss Manners or Dear Abby or, no, not Dear Abby, Emily Post. Miss Manners or Emily Post aren't going to come. They're not dinner party czars that have set up rules. They're like scribes who have observed lots of dinner parties take place and have written down that generally, if you have to, keep the Beef Wellington and skip the crackers. Rubrics, liturgical commissions, the existence of rubrics are not declarations by liturgy czars. They're observations. Even Kavanaugh calls them the principles which make the liturgy work. The rubrics are like a checklist for putting together a liturgy. For noting, oh my, we're an hour and a half in and they still have their coats on. Why did I forget to check their coats at the door? What is it that people need to check? Take off on their way in so that they can participate in the liturgy. Hard points and soft points, structures of a rite. You can play with this dinner party analogy yourself further on. I shall move to another point. I'm watching the clock. I would have a little more pause here if I wasn't watching the clock so closely. But let me see. Push. The reason that we're concerned about hard points and soft points is so that everyone can participate in this dinner party. If you know the structure in advance or by experience, then you can forget about the structure of the dinner party and enjoy the participation in the event, the conversation. I'm making a case here that the more structured it is, the more liberty for involvement is possible. If you came and there was a real surprise and you didn't know what was coming next because the host or hostess wanted to have a real interesting dinner party, not like the 101st dinner party we've served, same old structure, how boring to do the same thing Monday after Monday. if you thought that, then, how about if we served pizza and dessert first and then moved? And then you'd need a little program so that you knew where to go. Ooh, 7:15. Asterisk, stand up. I'm supposed to be in the living room. The more comfortable it is, the less you need all of that. So let me make a spin another parable for you to hammer at that point. What I'm about to say is completely overdone. I don't know whether this would stand up. This is like Perry Mason's trick in court when he used to badger a witness and then the judge would hammer down objection sustained and Perry Mason would say, I withdraw the question. But he'd already put the question in the juror's mind. At the end of this, I withdraw the question. I don't mean a word of what's about to follow. But it's too late. It'll already be in your minds. There are two great errors, mistakes about the liturgy. The first is to have texts come to mind when liturgy is mentioned. Liturgy is more a verb than a noun. Just as the word music can refer either to a score held in your hand or to the melodies heard by your ear, so the word liturgy can refer either to the text in the prayer book or to the activity in the sanctuary. And in both cases, I say the form. The music performed and the liturgy transacted are primary. The liturgical text only exists for the performance of the liturgy, and indeed it could be done without, as the lay people did without a liturgical score for 17 of the church's 20 centuries. Priests had sacramentaries, choirs had evangelions, lectors had gospel books and epistolorum, but the people did their liturgy, they didn't read it. Liturgy should not so much bring to mind written words as assemblies of people engaged in particular activities. One of my teachers at St. John's said that as a personal protest, every Catholic church he went into, he took one missalette out of the back pew and dropped it in a wastebasket on his way out. It was just a small but personal protest against reading through liturgies. Liturgy is something done, not written. The second error is to suppose that liturgy is done by the clergy. Liturgy is not the clergy's work, but the church's work. The clergy is not the orchestra making music for an audience, but the conductor presiding over the real music makers, the people of God. And so the assembly's place is not in the audience of the music hall, passive, but on stage with instruments in their hands. If you want to know where the liturgist is, look in the pews. I think that I am a liturgist. There's a liturgy director and there's a liturgy presider, but I am the liturgist. Our Western role is particularly Western tradition has particularly disenfranchised the assembly from their role. They're seated as in a lecture hall, thanks in large part to Mr. Furtenbach, in a theater, making it require an almost superhuman effort for them to crawl out of their pews onto the stage. How could I impress upon you the abnormal passivity in this otherwise normally active event? I'm going to spin a parable for you. Now, if I thought I could tell better stories, I'd let this stand on its own. Or if I wasn't an academic who likes to beat things to death, I'd let this story stand on its own. But as it is, I'm going to tell it and then extract some propositions. I suffer both these maladies. My story is about a death and a funeral. Suppose you had a good friend who died. His death saddens you such that it seems not enough to grieve him merely between the time the dining hall closes. Oh, this is geared for college kids, though. The dining hall closes and the evening film fest begins. You decide to go to the funeral home for the review. When you arrive, it strikes you how good it is to be there. It satisfies something within to be gathered in this place with mutual friends who have come to grieve and support one another. You are all there to commonly transact your grief. It occurs to you might even stay for much of the review, even though it lasts a couple hours. Oh, to be sure you won't stay in the same room the whole time, or express your grief the same way the whole time. There's a somber room where the body is, and also the room next door where coffee is served and you'll talk with one another. Your subjective state of sadness will wax and wane through the evening. Sometimes you'll laugh over a good memory and other remembering will move you to tears, but no matter. It's clear to you that your act of grieving is your reason for being there, even though the feelings inside come and go. Across the room, you see the family of your dead friend and are on your way over to give a consoling hug and try to put into words your condolences. When someone announces, "Would you all please find a seat? The director is about ready to begin the grief." Oh, you thought you were already grieving, but oh no, now the grief, capital T, capital G, is about to begin. In the middle of the room are several rows of benches upon which people are beginning to sit. On your way to find a seat, someone thrusts into your hands a mimeographed sheet with the words, "Order for Grieving," printed on top. The ink is smudged, that darn mimeo machine. They should have gotten those pre-printed forms from Fortress Press or Oregon Catholic Press. You overhear someone behind you whisper, "This isn't our regular director, but I hear he's very good." "Yes," comes the reply. "I saw him do a grief for Mrs. Johnson, and he was wonderful." You're about to greet a dear friend who has sat down beside you when the special music begins and your attention is distracted to the soloist. She's a very good singer, though you wish you and your friend would have had a chance to remember together. But now the grieving has already begun, and you must scurry to find your place on the mimeo sheet. Later in the grieving, you see there will be a speech from the director. It looks like his relevant, heartfelt words are, the announced topic, attitudes towards non-being and alienation as reflected in post-Hegelianism. Sounds like another rouser. You've been to some of these liturgies, haven't you? After his speech comes the litany of consolation, something to be read responsibly to the family as your personal words to them written neatly in blue and white. You think to yourself that it's a good thing you didn't bring Junior along. Not because he wasn't saddened by your friend's death. Not at all. He came to most of Junior's 8 birthday parties. But, you know, kids just can't grieve properly. He would get fidgety and start making some noise that would interfere with the grieving. Or start kicking the bench in front of him and distract the grievers. His own way of grieving at his own level of awareness and expression just isn't mature enough for real grieving yet. Lucky you dropped him off in the children's room where they'll read stories and draw cute pictures about death and have abstract discussions. I thought I could offend everyone in one go. You kind of wish you could go up to the casket and stand near your friend's body and see him and be there for a moment. It would feel like the right thing to do, but it's pretty clear that there's only room for one person up there, and that's the director. It's blocked off by the screen of flowers and the prohibitive railing up in front. But it certainly looks pretty from the back, here in the benches where you belong. The spotlights strike the banners in a soothing, griefful light. There's trucks going by the road. The floral arrangements are symmetrical. The banner has a thought for the day for you to chew on so that you can be active inside your cranium. I mean, if you can't go anywhere, if you can't be active corporeally, physically, then where can you be active? Ooh, what a feeling. Yes, I believe I'm having a feeling. And the organ drones out its brief muzak. Yes, this is a good grief, so pretty and well-directed. I'll submit to you the following propositions. 1, liturgy is an action, not a sentiment. As an act, the transaction could have a variety of subjective expressions. Our character could have socialized, laughed, wept, been alone or in communion, and all the while it would have been understood that he or she was grieving. Grieving was being transacted. We generally tend to associate worshiping with a particular interior feeling, often somber and gloomy, but that's what the old folks want. So feed some puppy uppers and then peppy and happy. And if you create that feeling, either a somber feeling or a peppy feeling, then we know worship has happened. And then we tend to discount as hypocritical those occasions when you go through the act without feeling the emotions inside. That's why the creation of a certain subjective state is so important. Lights go down, the spotlight hits the pulpit, the organ drones on to fill in the gaps. Pastors put on their stained glass voice and move in a churchy way called chancel prancing. It was your story, Bob, in class once, as a reply to someone who objected to communion more frequently than once a month, because it won't be special anymore, and you replied, that's why you make it a point to kiss your wife only once a month, so it's really special. When you meet.
Did I say that? I remember it.
I had a organist tell me that a pastor leaned over and said, why don't you play some fill here? And I just move chords to keep the momentum of the emotion in line.
A shovel full of dirt.
And he replied back, I don't feel like it. Why don't you just babble some nonsense syllables for a while here?
Yes.
Okay. I said I would take back the questions when I finished saying them. There's a point to the objection here. You can pass a threshold where if you're there without paying attention, if you say the words without noting any of their meaning, if you just make actions reflexively without any consciousness, then you pass from ritual into ritualism.
But not every act of worship has to be or can be expressed by the same subjective state. Not every meal can be Christmas, Thanksgiving, and the 4th of July poured into one. Godfrey Diekmann has a terrific argument on the tyranny of celebration. Did we celebrate? Was it a celebration? Was it good for you? Wait a minute. You can't make every liturgy move the earth. While we were in graduate school, someone just caught the innuendo. While we were in graduate school, Elizabeth brought home the lion's share of income, and I stayed home with our youngest son from 6 months to 3 years. Now, I could tell you that every lunchtime was this blissful, ecstatic expression of parenting love. But most of the time, it was getting the SpaghettiOs up before the sauce stained, cutting the hot dogs, and making sure the peas didn't get smashed into the carpet. But you know, there's something that I still look back fondly at, having done that day after day, week after week, month after month, year after year. Sometimes a feeling will create an action, but sometimes an action will create a passion if done over a long period of time. And liturgy is much more interested in passion than it is in feelings. See, a lovely little chapter in Romano Guardini's Meditations of the Mass distinguishing sentiment from sentimentality. Second proposition, don't force the participants into a passive state. I chose a funeral, but the same abnormal passivity could be reflected if I featured a wedding reception. I mean the reception now, not the wedding where the bride weds the groom and the groom weds the bride, and they're the ministers of the sacrament to each other in Catholic tradition. We're mainly witnesses, but not quite celebrating. I mean the celebration at the country club after. Would it feel odd if there was a reception where you sat down in rows and rows of folding chairs and you watched the bride and groom eat their wedding dinner, dance, toast one another? Shh, come on, cut the cake. Don't make any noise. Be quiet. Don't disturb the celebration. Wouldn't my celebration be more authentic if I too could laugh and visit and dance and eat? This is what Kavanaugh writes about pews in his book, Elements of Rite. I don't think anyone of any denomination should get out of seminary without reading Elements of Rite. Pews entered liturgical place only recently, and they nail the assembly down, proclaiming that the liturgy is not a common action, but a preachment perpetrated upon the seated. An ecclesiastical opera done by virtuosi for a paying audience. Pews distance the congregation, disenfranchise the faithful, and rend the assembly. Filling a church with immovable pews is similar to placing bleachers directly on a basketball court. It not only interferes with movement, but changes the event into something entirely different. Pews are never mentioned in Roman rubrics, nor is there any record that being without pews has ever killed Christians in significant numbers.
But it's kind of a given. I mean...
I wore my St. Latimer shirt today because we stood for liturgies. A whole hour? No.
3 hours.
A whole 3 hours. Do people stand for an hour of your dinner party? Do you stand for most of the football game? Did you notice how long we sit in Vespers? We're supposed to participate by means of it being very entertaining. But it's a hot medium which forces me into sitting back, not a cool medium which invites me in to participate. Third proposition, participation means symbolic activity, not didactic lecture. That was my point about children. The fact that children are taken to disrupt a liturgical worship exposes our faulty conception of liturgy as cinerama. I was going to say theater, but good theater could involve, well, all right, bad theater, let's say. As something done in front of the audience, liturgy is not a spectator sport. And children's reactions are amazing barometers of whether a liturgy is authentically involving the assembly. If they get bored, there may be too much activity up front. If they miss the point of the symbol, it may be the symbol is too weak. And what do you do when a symbol gets so weak that it degenerates into sign? You prop it up with flying buttresses of explanation. You turn it into words. If a symbol would work, you shouldn't need words to explain the symbol. If when you come to my dinner party, I'm going to come and welcome you, I shouldn't have to say,
Hello, I'm coming across the room with my hand extended as a cultural expression of welcome and hospitality. This isn't a threat. I'm going to shake your hand. Well, you're welcome. It's a very odd thing to go up and say, now we're going to have the procession. Now I'm going to welcome you to my home. Hello, I'm coming over. If you can't see me welcoming you to my home, the symbol was badly done. It was a bad symbol. Let it die a dignified or undignified death. Get it out of there. The less explanation that accompanies a liturgy, the better. Many liturgies fail because it feels like there's that voice of a golf commentator in the back. He's going over to the pulpit now. He's going to the liturgy of the Eucharist. He's taking out a... Rubrics are not meant to be read. They're not meant to be explained. They're just meant to make sure that the person gets from point to point on time. We take our kids to the Easter Vigil at Yale, held at the sleepy hour from 11:30 till 2 in the morning. And yes, they faded out during the scripture readings and the homily, but otherwise they stayed attentive because they could participate. They held the candle. They processed through the courtyard behind the cross. They got to watch a baptism if you were lucky. They at least got to be splashed in the renewal of their baptismal vow. They got to go from the lectern to gather around the altar, and maybe they were allowed to participate in Jesus' Supper, as we called it. Why do we prohibit children from doing the one thing they naturally do well, eat, and confine them to doing the one thing they don't do well, sit still and listen? 4, I wanted to complain about bulletins. The more unusual...
This is the harangue now?
Yes, haven't you noticed?
You didn't give us the rubric.
All right, normally you should move from one low side to another, but I thought the voice would be enough. The more unusual and entertaining it is, the more it requires a bulletin. You don't know what's coming next. Then you have to have a sheet of paper reminding you, letting you know what's coming next. But if the structure of the liturgy, I don't say the content, different prayers, different feasts, different lessons, different homilies, different homilies. I had a friend who said he would go out and preach anywhere because he had a sermon that always worked so long as he changed the opening line, which was, "Today, the Allies have liberated Paris." So long as he fixed that opening line. No, all right, so not repeating the homily either. The content changes. Do you get bored going to dinner parties? Oh, but you do the same thing. First we sit and talk, and then we have some hors d'oeuvres, and then we go to the table. Yes, yes, that's just the skeleton on which the event can hang. And if I reverse all of that, then I have to hand out bulletins. 7:15, sit in the living room, enjoy yourself, chit-chat. Oh, all right. You should know that you can sit in the living room now. You should know that chit-chat is appropriate. Lewis says the best liturgy is like an old shoe, which you don't notice the shoe, but can get on with the business of walking or perhaps dancing. But constant innovation distracts your attention from the action you came to do to the shoes, to the pinching shoe. 5, no virtuoso performances. Liturgy is not a performance by the pros for the untalented slobs. Activity which makes the congregation feel, "I can't do that," should be kept to a minimum. Avoid the temptation to perform. This applies to the organist, the choir director, and the pastor, if he or she is tempted to become too theatrical in style. It applies to liturgical dramas, youth Sundays, liturgical dance groups, pastors dressing up in clown suits, visiting college choirs, outreach teams, Boy Scout Sundays, etc., etc. Just as the mourner did not come to watch a grief, but to transact a grief, so the faithful do not come to watch or listen to a liturgy, no matter how excellently performed. They come to do a liturgy. No show, folks, save them for Sunday evening in the assembly hall. 6, I wanted to say something about architecture. Not being allowed to stand near the casket parallels the distancing of the table from the people. Look at the front of the sanctuary. Does the table invite you to approach it? Is the more prominent symbol something to look at or something to do? Does it seem like a two-dimensional and it could just as well be a play backdrop that can be rolled down and rolled up again? One of the first times this began to dawn on me was a time that I went to a altar area and it looked so nice in front of the statue of Jesus in the Garden of Gethsemane painted behind him, and I went behind this area and here were the matches for the acolytes and the electrical cords and dust and all sorts of junk. Oh yeah, it looks nice around here, but it's not done. It's like, you know, not polishing the back of your shoes, because who cares what people think of you as you walk away from them. The whole event has a certain kind of integrity to it. This says something about how obstructive are altar flowers, internal lights, microphone stands, altar railings, altar crosses, huge candlesticks, and Bibles that are permanently open to the Book of Psalms so that it doesn't tip over on the stand. If the book is too big to be used, why is it there? You likewise have another problem with books that are too small to be used. The material should fit the dignity of the occasion, which means reading the Holy Gospel off a pamphlet insert that tends to fold over in your hand is no good. Get yourself a notebook that you can set this in and make it look halfway decent. Only three pieces of furniture seem to be necessary in a liturgical space. A reading desk so you can do the liturgy of the word, a table so you can do the liturgy of the Eucharist, and a baptismal font so you can initiate new members into the community. Think of the space we could have if we got all this clutter out otherwise. My last point is the claim that liturgy is a corporate act, and corporate is the opposite. I'll set it up this way, because this is this seems to be the crux of the confusion about individual freedom and institutional structure. Liturgy is a corporate event, and corporate is the opposite of this word, and it is not the opposite of this word. And we tend, ask any person off the street, we tend to confuse these two words. Corporate is the opposite of private. Something cannot be corporate and private at the same time. And liturgy, by definition, is a corporate event. It cannot be, should not be, can be, unfortunately, shouldn't be private. But corporate is not the opposite of personal. I mean by personal, meaningful, significant, important. And we tend to confuse private and personal. Would it make Thanksgiving dinner more meaningful, more special, more Thanksgiving if, when you came home for Thanksgiving, instead of gathering everybody at this one big table, I gave you each your individual Swanson's turkey TV dinner so that you could take it up in bedrooms and kitchens and hallways scattered around the house, and you could sit there in private eating a really, really personal Thanksgiving dinner. Oh my, I appreciate this one. Why do we haul them all to the front table? Why was it such a rite of passage when you got to move from the card table with cousins up to the big table? Everyone remembers that. They all giggle. Because Thanksgiving is a corporate event, and its community quality makes it personal, makes it significant and meaningful. Corporate is the opposite of private. It's true that liturgy is not private, but it doesn't mean that liturgy, as corporate, as structured, as ritual, can't be personal. Bang, the judge's gavel falls. Objection sustained. I withdraw the question.